Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Molly Wheeler, and I will be the host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in over 55 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We encourage students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is ALEC and the Real Nature of Politics. Our guest today will be Lisa Nelson. Lisa is the CEO of the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, the largest nonpartisan voluntary membership organization of state legislators in the United States, dedicated to the principles of limited government, free markets, and federalism. ALEC counts nearly one quarter of all state legislators and hundreds of business leaders and entrepreneurs as members of the 42-year-old organization. Together, ALEC members discuss policy and develop real plans of action to protect hardworking taxpayers and create effective, efficient, and accountable state governments. Previous to her work with ALEC, she led the government relations for Visa, was a senior vice president of external relations for AOL Time Warner, and served as public affairs liaison for U.S. Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. Lisa is a political science and international relations graduate of UC Berkeley. She and her husband David live in Virginia and have two children. Please welcome me and join me in welcoming Lisa.
Thank you. So I know what you're thinking. How does a Berkeley grad become a conservative in Washington, D.C.? Actually, it was all Ronald Reagan. It's all his fault, I think. My career has been very, very fun, and as students here on campus or affiliated with the Hinckley Institute, I'm assuming that you're all either involved in public policy, involved in politics, involved in government, whether it's state or U.S.-based, and I just want to encourage that as much as possible on all sides, both sides of the aisle, independent, Republican, Democrat, across the board. I think it's fantastic to see people involved. I love what the Hinckley Institute is doing. And at the end, I will mention our internship program, but I just was talking to the folks at the Hinckley Institute and Gina about the program that we have. Last summer, I think we had 17 interns at ALEC. We're right in Crystal City, Roslyn, right by the National Airport, so we're not in D.C. proper, but it takes like 3 minutes to get from our office to the Capitol. We have a great internship program, and if there's any interest after I've spoken or after you get to know the organization a little bit, let us know, because we're right in the process of conducting those interviews and bringing people into Washington. So I want to make sure I have the clicker. We changed the name of the talk, the nature of politics. I don't know. I was kind of like, I'm not sure about that, to trust in innovation, and I want to talk a little bit about trust in your government, trust in your legislators, and innovation, which is one of the themes that ALEC is focusing on over the course of the next 2 years. In many cases, and I'll get into this a little bit deeper in this talk, but where it involves policy, where it involves solutions for individuals and voters, the technology is there. And the answers are there, and the technology is ready for you, but the legislation is oftentimes 10, 15 years behind. And I'll give you a few examples of that down the road. You said, I worked in the corporate sphere for about 16 years, whether it was AOL, Time Warner, or Visa, all different policy applications, content, intellectual property, internet, financial services. So the last 8 years was all financial services. Saw a lot of regulation of the financial services industry in the last 8 years, which we're dealing with, or which that industry is dealing with. But if you have questions after the fact and want to talk about that, we can. My sense is that I've been at ALEC 6 months. It's under new leadership, and my background kind of suits the organization really well, because ALEC is an organization, as described, of the legislators, so about a quarter of the legislators. There's 7,300 legislators in the country. So that's your state house and your state senate in all 50 states. So 7,300 of those. Our membership is about a quarter of that, so 25%. We have about 2,000 legislators who opt in and join ALEC. There's a couple of other legislative organizations. There's NCSL, the National State Legislative Organization, and a couple of others, Council of State Governments, things like that. But ALEC is the only one where you actually opt in. A legislator, state or house, senator house, will write his own personal check for $100 to join for 2 years. So we kind of we wear that as a badge of honor, because it means that that legislator that's a member is much more engaged, much more invested, and much more prepared to kind of work. So I like that about the organization. Trust and innovation, those are the building blocks, and I want to talk a little bit about that. Let me just see here. Up here is kind of what I want to cover: politics and trust, innovation and issues and resources. Funny little slide with potato chips and innovative trinkets, and then the map of the United States, because I do want to get into a little bit of the election returns and things like that and how they impact what we're doing. But let's see here. ALEC, 42 years old, founded in 1973, so about the same time, or maybe 5 or 7 years after the Hinckley Institute was founded, ALEC was founded. Ronald Reagan was president, and I think there was a lot of energy and enthusiasm around states and states' rights. I mentioned that about 2,000 of our members of the 7,800 are our members. We have a private and a public balance of our membership. So on the private sector, it's about 300 different industry representatives. And by that I mean think tanks, corporate interests, stakeholders that might be involved in any particular issue. So we really kind of feel like the breadth of our organization covers all the spectrums. The legislative membership is in all 50 states, as I mentioned. And the one really fun thing about ALEC is that once you've been in the state legislature, there's a lot of people who kind of look for running for higher office and thinking about other offices. We have 86 members who are ALEC alumni who are currently in Congress. And we have, it's not listed here, but we have 13 senators, including Joe Manchin, who is the Democrat senator from West Virginia. So that bipartisan nature, the majority of our alumni are Republican. I'd like to grow our Democrat membership. We used to alternate our chairmanship every year, Republican and Democrat. That's with the change in the election results at the state level. There's just less and less conservative, pro-market, free-market Democrats that we can kind of pull from. But that's a little bit of the makeup of it. Our agenda and our mission statement is limited government, free markets, and federalism. And, you know, I know that you know what limited government means. It means, you know, shrinking the size of government, mostly at the federal level, but always at the state level as well. Free markets is finding kind of that free market solution to any kind of problem or any kind of policy issue that has come up. And then lastly, federalism. It's a word that is, in Thomas Jefferson's age, was states' rights. Everybody understood what that meant. Right now, the pollsters, the wordsmiths, the people that kind of tell us how much language matters are saying that the word federalism is kind of confusing to a lot of people, because they think that it kind of equates to federalism. That means Congress, doesn't it? That means, you know, D.C., and I don't like D.C., and I don't like those guys that run things there. So what we like to say is that we're really focused on returning the balance of power back to the states. And you'll see that I just gave a radio interview this morning where the question was, what's the biggest hurdle you see? And my answer was that there's a lot of consolidation in Washington right now, whether it's at the FCC, whether they just came out with a rule this week to really regulate the internet, whether it's the EPA that's putting out all their rules who are regulating environmental issues, whether it's the executive branch on financial institutions cracking down. But that consolidation is happening, and we're really focused on returning that balance of power. We think it's about you. We think that you sitting here and your legislators in Utah should make the decisions about what people in Utah are living with, or what policies you live under. So that's the federalism that I'm talking about. Just a second on the map. It's kind of interesting to think through kind of where we've been and what's happened. In the November elections, and I think we handed this out or made it available to folks if you want to take it with you. It's fun to look at this map before November and after November, but we've just got the one in kind of post-November elections. I think it's important to understand that in that election, there were 82% of the country's state legislators were up for election. So you have some states, New Jersey, Mississippi, Kentucky, who have off-year elections, so those three weren't up in 14. They're actually up this year. So you'll see some political involvement this year in those three states, and sometimes Louisiana has off-year elections. But the results of the November elections actually flipped chambers. So from that's changing power, changing control in 11 chambers. And thereby turning a lot of those red. So what that means is right now, and I'll do both Democrats and Republicans, but the GOP controls both chambers in 31 states, including Nebraska, which is unicameral and doesn't do party control. But in addition to controlling both the Senate and the House, they actually also have the governorship in 23 states. So I call that the trifecta for the GOP in 23 states. Conversely, and with the Democrats, they control both chambers in 11 states, and you'll see them there. It's hard to get to 11, but actually with the Northeast, that actually is a number of different states. Obviously in California and Oregon, and then mostly in the Northeast. Of those 11 states, they've got 7 where they have the governorship. And California and Oregon are clearly two of those. In Utah here, just like across the rest of the country, a quarter of the legislators are members of ALEC. So 26 members are 26 of your Utah Senate or House are members of ALEC. I'm going to be going and meeting with them this afternoon with the governor to talk about one of our publications. We do a publication every year called Rich States, Poor States. And it talks about the competitiveness of a state, and it compares tax reform on a whole host of different levels. Utah has been number one in our book for 7 years straight. And that's something that we want to recognize and hail, and that's why we're here today, is to spend some time with the governor and the legislators, encouraging them to keep on going, to pass more tax reform. Interestingly, we've already predicted that in 2015 we'll see tax reform in both blue and red states, probably to the tune of 15 or 20 states, because the November elections, while they might seem political, Democrat, Republican, actually, if you dig a little deeper, where there was change was where tax reform and fiscal conservative policies actually were taking place. So it's an interesting phenomenon. In New York right now, they're running bills on tax cuts in 2015. So they're following the Utah model and really pushing that. We see this as kind of a rising tide of the idea and the notion of limited government. And we're hoping that because we're out in the states, we, ALEC, that rising tide will continue and we'll continue to see more fiscal reform. Interesting to note, I see a lot of women in the audience, that more women today hold elective office than in any other point in U.S. history. There were 8 women elected into Senate and the House in Washington. Some of them are my good friends, and many of them are former legislators. So that's exciting. That's exciting to see. When you look at this map and you think about kind of the political dynamic in this country, it's important to recognize that it's almost flipped in the control. In many of your lifetime, Democrats have held the White House, you know, most of what you've known, right? President Obama has been in office for almost 7 years. It used to be in the 80s and 90s that the Republicans controlled the administration and that the Democrats really controlled that map. And they had the power at the state level. In my lifetime, that's completely flipped. And I find that interesting. You know, it's possible that we'll see another Democrat in the White House after 2016, which would further kind of prove that point and reinforce that point. As you see this consolidation on the Republican side of the state house, people are always looking for that balance of power, whether it's Republicans in elective office in Washington and Democrats at the state houses or vice versa. So I think that's really important. How many of you can remember the last 5 presidents? Anybody? Name the last 5 presidents. I'm sure you can. Someone in the back can, right? Who are they? Yep, that's right. That's right. I thought about that today because my children are 22 and 20. They're in college. And I think about, you know, I talk about Ronald Reagan a lot. I talk about Bill Clinton a lot. I worked with Newt Gingrich when President Clinton was in office. And believe it or not, it was a great combination. We balanced the budget many times. We passed welfare reform. We had a great kind of working relationship with Gingrich, Clinton, and Trent Lott, who was the majority leader. And if you can have that kind of camaraderie and working relationship, that's a really good dynamic to have in Washington. So a little bit on trust and talking about how we kind of operate. Our view is that if you don't trust your government, you're going to be disenfranchised, you're going to be disenchanted, you're going to feel frustrated at decisions that are made. So what we're really focusing on is building those blocks at ALEC between the legislators and the American people. We have 3 meetings a year where we go out and really talk about policy issues, what's on the horizon, what needs to be happening at the states, and that is really the generation of that legislation. All of the 700 model policies that we have online right now have been driven by the legislators. They're voted on by the legislators. They're passed by our board, which is all legislator-driven. So that's a really important point because a lot of the coverage and a lot of the media around organizations writ large is that it's driven by special interests or different corporate interests and things like that. And it's really important to know that we feel like the model policies we have in our system have been driven by legislators who believe that it's the right policy for their states and for their constituents. We're all about real solutions and real results, so focused on that. That's how we kind of drive our focus on the legislative policy that we pursue. On this slide, it's a little bit like thinking through, you know, what's the next generation? Where are we going to be? Like I said, I've got kids 22 and 20. They are they're not disenfranchised, but they are a little frustrated at government. They don't understand kind of that connection. And when I talked a little bit about the technology is there, but the legislation is not, that's a real kind of driver, I think, for people who are in college and in university right now. If you look at the stats right now, and Utah is really a model for this, and which is why we want to kind of encourage this, unemployment rate for youth in Utah, 7.7. But the general unemployment is 3.5, which is below the national rate of 6%. And that's, you know, that's a critical differentiation. I think it's important to recognize there's new jobs. I was just talking to someone about the Silicon Slope here in Utah, where eBay and some of the other tech companies are kind of relocating from California and that kind of high tax state to Utah. So I think that's an important element to focus on. If you look at the issues on the left, I won't go through them, but it really does focus on kind of where the millennials are and what they're seeing. We follow something called the Edelman Trust Barometer. It's been going on for about 10 years in 20 different countries. I guess I would like to ask you a question. How many of you trust your professor? The majority of you. How many of you trust Uber? Ooh, that's interesting. How many of you trust your elected official? That's what I figured. So it's all about trust, and this is a common phenomenon, trusting your professor, trusting where you get your news, and the like is really important. I think that the real focus right now is I trust my friends and family. I don't consider elected officials as a part of that. You can see where that distrust is. There's been a lot of campaign out there around online personalities, online celebrities and things like that. But this barometer speaks volumes about where we want to head. We want you to trust your local state elected officials, and we really want to kind of drive the relationship and get young people involved in getting to know their legislators, working with their legislators, and learning from their legislators, or teaching their legislators the new way of thinking, a new innovative way of deriving policy. Right there is academic expert companies I use. That's the trust factor. That's you making your own decisions, you driving your own decision-making and spending habits. And then, of course, elected officials and celebrities down at the bottom of the list. I'm frankly surprised that celebrities ranks so low. I figure that people, you know, read so much about it that they must trust it, but maybe that's not the case. And then I think it's important to look at where people are getting their information. Different sources, mostly online. How many of you watch the nightly news anymore? Anybody? 6 o'clock, 6:30. It used to be that you would race home from work to get home so you could watch, you know, Walter Cronkite or you know, whoever was leading it. I'm sure you're following the flap with Brian Williams and whether he made up a story about being in enemy fire or not. But he's supposed to be the most trusted man in America. He delivers the news every night of the week. And it turns out he made up a story. So for those of you who get your news from the internet, it's up to you to make sure that you source it and determine whether it's true. We find that a lot of things that are said about our organization don't represent fact on what we're doing. We're often mischaracterized or misrepresented according to someone's view or according to someone's opinion. So if that's happening to us, it's probably happening to other people. I think for you to discriminate where you get your news and how you digest your news is really important as you get involved in and active in any kind of policy information. The first source of news is the internet, and people's place to validate the information is on the internet. If you have a question, you're at a party and someone asks a question, you ask Siri, you ask the internet. So that's a really critical place. The interesting thing for me is that right now people are watching less than 7 minutes a week of the nightly news. And yet that's where a lot of the stories are generated from and politics and kind of messaging comes from. So I think that's a critical kind of inflection point for us to be focused on. And as we talk about back to the potato chips, this is a really interesting slide, and I think it kind of hopefully will sink in a little bit for you. The discussion is around how much money is spent on politics. And there's all kinds of people that will tell you there's too much money in politics. There's too much money in campaigns. And yes, if you're in a state that's a battleground state and you're getting bombarded with those ads, it can get a little bit overwhelming. But having said that, this is the 2014 numbers just from the FEC reports. The FEC is the Federal Election Commission. $2.87 billion. This is not campaign spending. This is actual advocacy for your policies and your interests. So this is what people in the newspapers would say lobbying. $2.87 billion was spent on advocating, educating, lobbying for whatever it is you're interested in. $6 billion in the same year was spent on potato chips in this country. And I guess I would argue that, we are the free world. We've got, a democracy that is rivaled and followed by many, many countries. I would argue there's probably not enough money in politics if this is the case. Just to exacerbate that a little bit further, Barack Obama and Mitt Romney each spent probably a little over $1 billion in the campaign in 2012. So maybe totaling, $2 billion plus, a little bit plus. So twice as much money was spent on determining who the leader of the free world was going to be, twice as much was spent on potato chips than in determining who the leader of the free world is. So it's a nuance, and it's a lot of people would disagree, but I think that, when we think about educating and advocating and talking about policies that are going to be implemented and put into place, it's really important to understand where are America's priorities? What are we focused on? And you can do this slide on many other different examples, whether it's how much money we spend on sports, television, all of the above. But I think it's really important to kind of think about what our priorities are and where we're focused. Now, trying to transition a little bit to innovation. I mentioned it very early on. We believe that we are a 2015 world living in a 1950s government, and I'll give you a few examples in a minute. But it's our focus and purpose for the next 2 years to inject innovation into legislation, not just into the discussion, but actually trying to look for innovative ways to create legislation that would actually drive legislation. We started a Center for Innovation and Technology at ALEC when I came on board, primarily focused to write and author a book which would be called, I think, Innovation Index. And it would be a state-by-state review of what states are doing in their local jurisdictions to drive innovation. Again, Utah is going to rank very, very high up there. You're creating incentives for companies to come into the state, and from eBay and Nextel and all the other ones that are coming into the Silicon Slope. But why aren't states like California looking for ways to drive that innovation? They're just raising taxes and making it harder and harder for business to actually do business in the state. So we really are trying to focus on that for this year and next. We are working with legislators to come up with innovative solutions. And specifically, I'll just talk about six different areas where we think it's kind of critical. One, in the transportation field, Elon Musk of Tesla said just this year that by 2018, all Teslas will be able to drive themselves 97% of the time. That's an incredible goal. I don't know if he'll be able to achieve that, but that's an incredible goal. Now, what does that mean for our legislation and the things that we talk about in our state legislators? Right now, you've got, I think Utah legislature is debating a gas tax. Well, okay, you're debating a gas tax, but half the people in Utah might be driving electric cars, in a few years. Why are we talking about gas tax when we're also talking about new innovative solutions around transportation and driving? Similarly, in education, how many of you had an iPad at your high school? Anybody? Not yet, but right now, every high school is distributing iPads to their students, or at least trying to. so that they can get their textbooks online. They don't, you know, there's no more hard copy, heavy textbooks coming out. That's an important element to my kids' student, their classrooms. Everything is driven online. They turn in their papers online. They get their assignments online. You go to your lectures, but everything else is happening online. So education technology is really becoming a critical new way of thinking. Healthcare, just like that, takes 15 and a half years for the FDA, the Federal Drug Administration, to approve a new drug. 15 years. So you've got a family member who's sick and who's dying. You know there's a drug out there that might save their life. Is there a way to focus in on that? So new innovative solutions are these right-to-try policies that are being passed in different states that say essentially allows some dying patients to try these breakthrough drugs if they sign the no liability clause. But that's an important step. You're having doctor house calls now taking place through Skype. And you're going back to, my dad was a doctor at Stanford, you're going back to the house call. They come right into your kitchen or your living room, talk to you about what ails you, and you can figure out what's going on. Half the time you take your phone for a diabetic, you can check your sugar levels and your sugar intake. You can take your temperature with your phone. You can have all of your medical records on your phone. So that's a really important new innovation, and I think will be streamlining and really strengthening the healthcare situation going forward. Government services is a really fun area. I talked about the Iowa driver's licenses. Two other states, I think, are following along, putting your driver's license on your phone. You know, I think many of us have stood in the DMV waiting in line for our driver's license. Imagine a world where you could just, you know, apply for it, take the test, do everything online, and not have to go to that DMV and wait for an hour and a half. The tax code's a fun one. We talk a lot about tax codes at ALEC. We have a tax code that is thousands of pages. By way of comparison, I think this is an interesting one. Our U.S. tax code is over 1 million words. The Bible is 780,000 words. So imagine that the U.S. tax code, you know, do we really need something that complex, that kind of bureaucratic to live by? And then finally, over-criminalization, which is a new issue, or not new issue, but I think it's become a new hot issue that politicians are looking at. And this is one where I think people just got it wrong 10 years ago. If you were involved in this debate 10 years ago, politicians were talking about three strikes and you're out, or even one strike and you're out. In Virginia, you'd get penalties put in place after one or two strikes. The problem has created over-criminalization in our prisons and in our reform system. And what we're really focused on is saying, wait a minute, why in one state is something totally legal and another state, you know, you're going to jail for it? What's wrong with the system, and why are we taking ordinary citizens and making them into criminals when it might be an infraction or it might be a loose situation? So this over-criminalization is really focused on getting people back on the streets, coming up with ways to matriculate them back into the workforce, and I'm really excited about it. It's one where ALEC is working. We're working with the ACLU. We're working with a ton of different Democrat groups on this, and there's a great coalition in Washington with Democrat and Republican senior elected officials that are working on this. So that's a really exciting one, and I think Utah this week or next week is considering legislation on reducing its prison population, so looking at innovative ways to kind of solve that problem. Finally, on resources, I talked a little bit about some of these documents. We have a couple copies in the back, I think, but we publish a lot of things out of ALEC, and that's part of our goal to really build that trust and really talk about our solution to the issues. The one on the left, Rich States, Poor States, is our seventh annual book that ranks the states in order of, you know, their effectiveness and growing the economy. Like I said, Utah has been number one for 7 years. So hopefully in 15 you will be too, and that's what we'll be talking about with the legislators this afternoon. The middle publication, Innovate Policies for the Future, kind of takes a lot of the issues that I talked about and has suggested policy solutions for the states. So we're often, you know, kind of handing a legislator, here, you have a question on that issue, here's an idea, here's a solution. So that's our document for 2015, kind of leading them into something that they might want to do. The report card on the right is the same thing the Rich States, Poor States is, which is an index of the states, but it's primarily driven by charter schools and by school choice. So we rank the states there based on how have they started to look for creative ways to have a better educational system. We do not think that more money is the answer. We think that more creativity, private sector charter schools, school choice for parents is a much better way to go. And then down below, we have state factors. We put out a number of state factors on different issues, whether it's online or by mail. But we put out, we just did one on pension that we worked with Dan Lilienquist, who is a former state legislator here in Utah, on. But that's our publications. We do blog posts every day, all day long. We have 9 different task force directors that break out into all of those areas, whether it's education, healthcare, tax reform, and each of those task force directors is responsible for building their task force and growing the number of members, both legislatively and private sector, but also for publishing, promoting, and putting the word out on their solutions and their work. So that's it. I will stop now, and I'm sure there's a lot of questions, or I hope there's a lot of questions. Again, to reiterate, as far as resources, ALEC does have an internship program. If you're interested in coming to Washington and you're focused on free market principles and limited government and returning power back to the states, we'd love to have you apply. We have many, many open slots, and we'd love to bring you out to Washington for more fun and engagement. So thank you very much. Okay. Go ahead. Do you want to give the microphone to her?
Yeah, I'm just trying to.
Balance the budget and do a lot of really productive things, even though it was 2 separate parties. And I wondered if you could put your finger on some key things that worked and why we aren't seeing them currently with President Obama and the divided Congress.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the question. It's fun to talk about. So, 1994 was when the Republicans took control of the House for the first time in 40 years. So there had been, like I said, a dearth of Republican leadership in the House, and I ran the organization that helped take it over. So when Newt came on to be Speaker, there was a lot of energy and excitement around the policies. If you don't remember, if you have read about it, the campaign was around a contract with America. We went out in 1993 and 94 and basically found 10 different things that had 74% or more approval of the country and said, we're going to make all these things happen. And literally the first 100 days, we passed all 10 of those pieces of legislation. So there was a lot of energy and momentum. To your question about that collaboration in the White House, Bill Clinton signed many of those bills. We passed, the toughest part was it took us 3 times to get the president to sign welfare reform. We passed it twice. The third time, and importantly, in his second term, he signed the welfare reform bill. I think that presidents tend, and this would stand for Republicans or Democrats, they tend to look at their ability to do things differently the first term and the second term. So a lot of the collaboration, a lot of the work that we did was in the second term when he took a look at the election results of 1996. So you had 94 when the House went Republican, and then 96 when the Senate also went Republican. And he said, I better move a little bit, or I better kind of you know, work with these people a little bit more. There was a lot of speculation after the 14 elections that President Obama might do the same thing. His calculation, I think, has been a little bit different. You know, he just hasn't, he hasn't kind of made that affirmative decision that maybe he wants to try to find a balance. I think there are a lot of pieces of legislation that right now the White House and the House and Senate are working on. I thought one of them might have been immigration. That seems to be kind of slowly losing its opportunity. And it comes down to personalities, comes down to a will to get the job done. And it also comes down to both the House and the Senate and the White House really, you know, trying to find a middle ground as opposed to planting their flag over here and planting their flag over here. So it's an interesting phenomenon, and I think part of it is just we live in a time when there's just a little bit more differentiation between one side and the other. But I really hope that, you know, that's one of my goals, is to get more Democrats in ALEC, to get more Democrats engaged that are really want to drive kind of limited government policies forward. And I think that there's a lot of people in Washington who feel the same way. It's just under such a microscope that it's hard to do.
Hi, my name is Dane. I appreciate your perspective on these matters. I got a little apprehensive when you went over limited government, but I think all of your approaches are very realistic, especially the campaign spending analogy you gave. And my question is, maybe if my apprehension reflects many of the states in the United States where they're afraid to make changes, that they've always, you know, stuck with their ways. You mentioned Utah's pursuing some criminal justice reform. What other areas of Utah specifically are we moving towards changing for the better in areas that we haven't in the past?
Well, I might have to defer to Kirk on something like that, or maybe wait till after I have my meeting with the legislators. But I think that it's important when you think through some of our issues. We've got there's minimum wage issues that are out there, and pay wage issues that are out there. I think in the healthcare space, there's innovative solutions towards using technology for creating a better healthcare system. Some of the states are frustrated because the answer is, you know, or the question is, do you take Medicaid expansion? Do you take the government funds, and then how do you use it? And you know, a lot of Republican governors at least don't want to take that government-funded mandate from Washington and then kind of admit that they're going to use it, you know, somehow. So in each of those areas, I think it's incumbent on the state legislators to look at those private sector solutions. What other things are you guys contemplating this week in the Congress? Do you know, Kirk? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I don't want to.
Well, thanks. Yeah, the thing I'm most excited about that you mentioned is the justice reform. I think the prison reform is a huge step, and I'd love to see the conservatives start to take the lead on changing that. Utah right now is really fighting about healthy Utah.
That's right.
That's probably the single biggest one. And then there's been a great combination of the LGBT community and the LDS Church and other faith-based institutions coming together on a discrimination bill, and so hopefully it'll work. The place where I think we're in the worst spot is we've got a Republican Party leadership, but not the Republican Party, has had a little bit of fight over the future of our elections. The Republicans in general want more participation. There's a few leadership who are trying to pull that back, but so far they've made the right vote, so we hope it'll continue.
Well, and I think in that case, I think the Utah legislature, you know, passed a bill last year. I think ALEC would support keeping that bill in place and really supporting not rolling back that participation that they moved forward on. Did you have a question?
Yeah, my name is Lexi Sheffield. You talked about how 24% of 18 to 24-year-olds voted in the 2010 election. I was just wondering if you anticipated that more in that age group would vote if they as their trust builds in the local officials, or how you plan to solve that issue of low voting in that demographic.
Right. Well, you know, and here's where I would tip my hat to President Obama, because that number was even higher. It was higher in 2008 when he first got elected. 4 years later, that millennial vote dropped. I think he did an amazing job of bringing more people to the polls, and that's a lesson that we all have to learn from. I mean, I think Democrats and Republicans alike really want more engagement, you know, and yeah, they want them for their side or their side, but the main thing, and what Hinckley Institute is all about, is more engagement and more involvement, and the better educated you are on the issues, then you can make your decision and hopefully make the right decision. For us, you know, we're not driving our decisions around a presidential election. More people voting is clearly better for everybody. We're so focused on the state legislative houses, and we're not really, because we're a 501c3, we're not focused on the campaign itself. We're focused on the policies once you get elected. So we'll work with anyone who gets elected. We just want you to move forward free market and limited government policies. Having said that, I have initiated a couple of different things while I'm in my 6 months here at ALEC. One is an outreach to Democrats. Another is an outreach to women legislators. And I was just in California where the whole discussion, this was at a house in Los Angeles. There was a number of young, new legislators in Los Angeles. And, you know, it's possible that we'll do a whole outreach for those new legislators that are coming on board. It's really encouraging when you see the makeup of our legislators now, because there are, I think the youngest legislator in the United States is an 18-year-old woman from West Virginia. So she's in, I don't know if you guys are nodding, you know about this, but there's, I think, 12 to 14 that are under 25. So we're really wanting to kind of reach out and get in touch with them and find out what got them involved, and then use that as a catalyst to maybe drive that voter turnout. Good question. Something we all need to be focused on.
Any other questions? We have time for about one more.
Nothing else? Kirk?
Kirk.
Uh-oh. This is going to be the zinger.
Well, I thank you first for being here. It's great to have you. And one thing I think the students would love to hear is you've had a pretty incredible career to have gone from deep in politics with Newt and Contract with America, but then essentially you were on the rise of the internet with AOL, and then Time Warner and the great movies and magazines and everything they do, and then of course Visa. Can you just give them a glimpse of what it's like to head the government relations of these type of major corporations?
Yeah, I've gotten very, very lucky. I really haven't ever had to look for a job. Jobs have kind of come to me. My start in politics was because I was a Reagan baby. There's, you know, books about kind of when you grow up and when you come of age. And I really was a Reagan baby. He was the governor of California when I was there. I don't know if we'll ever see another Republican governor of California. But when he came to the White House, I decided, when I finish school, I'm going to go to Washington and work for Ronald Reagan, and that's what I did. From there, I kind of fell into a number of very interesting jobs. What happens when you're working on the Hill is you get involved in policy, right? And so you get to know. And I was the public liaison officer for the Speaker of the House, so pretty much everyone knew me, and if you had a problem, you could call me and get to me, and I would get you to the right policy person in the office. And, you know, while Newt was a representative of Georgia and his district, once you become Speaker of the House, you really are the representative of, you're the Speaker of the whole House. So our issues and the entrees that we had were not kind of district specific or parochial in any way. We were getting calls and people coming in from all over the country. So I went to AOL. AOL was, believe it or not, we didn't have cell phones on the Hill. We had little pagers, and you could kind of talk, but you didn't have, you know, and it was, I think, not until the end that we actually got a BlackBerry. and then kind of moved to the internet. So, I mean, it's hard to imagine that we used to operate in the capital without cell phones and without BlackBerries or without your iPhone, and, you know, apps didn't exist. So our big educational effort at AOL was to bring members of Congress out to the campus and teach them how to work on the internet and how to surf the internet. Literally, we would take, on Friday afternoons, we'd take 12 to 15 members of Congress and put them in front of this big, huge white screen and say, start surfing, you know, and these guys didn't know what to do. From there, Time Warner, which was really fun. And it's interesting to see, so I've had a glimpse of corporate America in its best and in its worst in terms of mergers and acquisitions and things like that. I used to say that I was a part of the largest merger in the world, which was the AOL Time Warner merger, and the largest IPO in the world, which was the Visa IPO. I can't say that anymore because Alibaba, I think, beat out Visa a couple months ago. But I took pride in the fact that I was at those offices. Government relations offices for big major companies are generally 5 to 8 people, 8 to 10 people, depending the size on the company. And they will have people on their teams that specify and work specifically on, you know, whether it's content issues for Time Warner. We were always focused on intellectual property and legislation that helped us protect that intellectual property. You know, stealing CDs, the internet, Napster, and all those kinds of things became huge issues for us back then. So you develop an expertise not only in the issue, but you also, as a government relations kind of advocate for your company, need to develop relationships with the staff that works on the Hill that specializes in those issues. So at Time Warner, my kind of committee of jurisdiction was judiciary. And I knew every judiciary member, I knew every judiciary senator, and I knew every staffer for every one of those elected officials. So you make it your business, and that's your job to kind of get to know them. Of course, at Visa, it was financial services, so you go to the financial services committee. You make sure you have those relationships. He's giving me the high sign to wrap it up. But government relations officials, it's a really fun and wonderful job because if you love the company you work for, you can advocate for them. You know, and that's, you get paid to talk about how great a company is and how great their new products are. So that part was really fun.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I think we're about out of time, but we, on behalf of the Hinckley Institute, would like to thank Lisa Nelson and Alec for being here. And would you all please join me in giving her another round of applause?
Thank you.
And thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.